And welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer. And for the rest of this hour, we're going to update the high-profile case of the FBI against Apple. You may remember the government wanted a court order forcing Apple to unlock the San Bernardino shooter's iPhone. That case was set to be in court yesterday, but Monday, the government said, well, actually, we can open it without Apple's help. They say a mysterious third party offered a way to hack into the phone. The case has now been put on hold. In this hour, a look at this latest twist in what has become a very high-profile case with high stakes. Joining me, Aarti Shahani, tech reporter for NPR. Aarti, good to see you.
Hi.
Also with us by phone, Ashkin Soltani. He's an independent researcher and technologist. He was previously senior advisor to the U.S. Chief Technology Officer in the White House and also chief technologist for the Federal Trade Commission. And Ashkin Soltani, thank you as well for being here. Let me begin with you. Aarti, talk about the timing of this. I mean, I had been hearing, as I'm sure you have, for weeks that, they really just wanted a court precedent, a legal precedent that they did know how to get into this phone. What's your take?
Yeah, I mean, the timing is really interesting. And just to sort of, lay out what happened in the big play-by-play, in the middle of February, the FBI or the Justice Department went into court and they said, hey, we've been trying to get into this phone. We can't do it. And in their motion to the judge said repeatedly, Apple is the only entity that can help us get into this phone. No one else can do it. Only Apple can do it. And they held by that position publicly. And then actually leading up to the hearing a few days before their final motion, they had actually asked the judge, oh, can we actually change how the hearing's going to be? Let's make it an evidentiary hearing where we're not just making our legal case, but we get to cross-examine the other side. Apple basically last minute had agreed to that. And they're like, OK, here's another change in the format. And then on Monday, the day before the hearing was supposed to happen in Riverside Court, the Justice Department said, oh, well, you know what? On Sunday, someone came by and they did a demonstration.
Someone
for us.
Came by. Okay.
I mean, their official wording was an other party. They didn't say someone came by, but an outside party demonstrated that it would be possible to get into the iPhone. Now, what I find interesting about it is that they didn't say we have gotten into it. They said an outside party demonstrated it as feasible. And on a call with law enforcement officials, I actually asked on Monday, well, since you're not in yet, why not just go ahead into court and have it out so that you cover both bases? Either your outside party can help you or the court will help you. And then the law enforcement official said, we are cautiously optimistic we'll be able to get in, which I think their diplomatic way of saying we don't want to be in court right now.
Yeah. Ashkin Soltani, what's your take on both the timing and the substance of what happened on Monday?
I think Aarti had a pretty dead on in terms of the timing. The thing to also kind of read into it a little bit, is that what the government said is that they have no way to get into the device kind of non-destructively. And what that means is, there have been ways that experts like myself and others have suggested would be possible with this particular model of the phone. It's an older iPhone running kind of an older hardware chipset that doesn't necessarily have the same security protections as the current version of the iPhone you could buy at the store. And what I suspect happened is a company, and today it was reported through Reuters that it's an Israeli company called Cellebrite that provides law enforcement access tools, as well as those tools if you walk into T-Mobile and they clone your phone, or if you walk into AT&T and they copy your phone to a new one. That's usually provided by the same company, Cellebrite. I believe that this company might have if the reporting is correct, it's this company might have provided the FBI with a way to clone the phone in a way such that they could provide the attempts they need to without risking destroying the evidence on the device.
Go ahead. Finish. Yeah, finish your thought.
And in fact, this recently at a hearing with at a House hearing on this matter, where Daryl Issa directly asked Director Comey as to whether he's looked into this mirroring method, or they called it NAND mirroring, which is the kind of non-volatile memory on the device. So what I believe happened is that perhaps the FBI's position, and again, the case is not canceled, right? It's just been postponed until they investigate and exhaust all options. I feel like they presumably might not have a choice if someone provides them with a feasible solution that they must pursue before appearing in a judge and saying, yes, we've reasonably tried all avenues, and the only one remaining is for Apple to help us.
Arthi Jahani, there was a front page, I think, New York Times story this morning, which I suspect you saw, about a black market for hackers who discover ways to break into iPhones and other devices, and that the article pointed out that it would probably be more likely for a hacker in that case to go to the government than to Apple.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts about that, and why would that be so?
I mean, that article and the issue it's raising gets at the economics of finding vulnerabilities. And interestingly, you know, Apple, and this might actually sound quite counterintuitive to people, but it's important to explain. In the software economy, where the presumption is there will always be holes in software, there will always be flaws, and you have to continually race to find them and close them before your adversaries do, a lot of the most tech-forward companies like Google, like Facebook, have created what are called bug bounty programs, where they're like, okay, we know people outside are attacking our system. Go ahead and attack it. And if you find something good, tell us and we'll pay you for it. You know, maybe a few thousand, maybe a million, but we'll pay you for it. Apple doesn't have that kind of program. And so one of the companies that tries to encourage tech firms to have that, this company called Bug Crowd, was making the point that because Apple isn't paying for these kinds of rewards, why would a hacker be incentivized to go to Apple?
Why wouldn't Apple do that? Why wouldn't they have a program like
that?
Well,
you know, this gets at, you know, I'm curious what Ashkan thinks and what others think about this. I think one thing about the culture of Apple is that they have a fairly closed, you know, company. And they really, you know, they pride themselves on being the very best in their design of their you know, phone. So I actually even read this whole standoff with the FBI and the bigger issues it raises around public policy is, in a sense, Apple saying, hello, we have decided how best to design a phone. We have decided that this is best for consumer privacy as well as for security. I don't think that Apple is just speaking to privacy. I think that they've made a security calculation. And we have decided that we want to fully encrypt the phone. And we're Apple. We know what we're doing.
Mm. Ashkan, does this situation leave us feeling, should it leave us feeling safer, more vulnerable? You know, how do you assess that aspect of this?
So the point that Arthi made around bug bounty programs is an important one about the economics of this market. So most firms, and having come from the FTC, we kind of suggested that bug bounty programs are relying on the community, the security community at large, to review and test your products is a good practice. Most firms like Google and Facebook and others have a bug bounty program, which is if you as a security researcher identify a security flaw in their software and report it to them, the company will credit you with that finding and perhaps pay out some amount of money. I've actually personally done this for a couple of bugs with Apple, and others have done it for Google and Facebook and other, you know, other large companies. The challenge is that the economics are not kind of in the favor of the firms, right? So there's been some reporting around Apple, the latest version of Apple iOS bugs, or what are known as zero-day vulnerabilities, vulnerabilities that have not been disclosed publicly previously, going for on the upwards of $1 million for of a given vulnerability. And what that creates is it creates incentives for kind of researchers to not only find these bugs, which they were doing before, but rather than feed them into the kind of companies and generally raise the security of everyone involved, provide them almost like weapons to the highest bidder, such that whoever purchases the vulnerability is able to then exploit the targets they want to attack. Now, for the general audience, it's unlikely that someone will burn a $1 million bug on attacking them, or, you know, or use you know, this resource on them. But for nation states and for governments, it's a different issue.
All right, that's Ashkan Soltani, independent researcher, technologist, formerly the senior advisor to the U.S. Chief Technology Officer in the White House. He's here along with Arthi Jahani, a tech reporter for NPR. We're talking about the latest developments in the FBI's case against Apple with regard to the shooter in San Bernardino and that iPhone. If you want to join us, it's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can also email us. It's forum at kqed.org. KQED.org or tweet us. We're at KQED Forum. And, of course, you can leave a Facebook comment as well. This comes, of course, Arthi, in a week when we've seen this another horrific attack in Brussels. And I'm wondering what you think, that, you know, given the context for all this, how does this now, you have the presidential candidates weighing in and talking about what to do about ISIS and everything else, does it change or does it color this conversation in any way?
I mean, I think that what we're seeing through the tragedy in Brussels, through the tragedy in San Bernardino, and then much more garden variety offenses like tax evasion, is that in different instances, law enforcement agencies are finding themselves in a conundrum, which is that when it comes to data that is stored on the cloud, internet companies have a way to respond to requests for lawful intercept. They have a way to assess, oh, okay, yeah, you actually have a warrant. We can hand this over to you. So that they have an avenue there. But when it comes to information that's now being stored on the physical phone, on the hardware device, companies are beginning to design it in a way such that you can't get in. You know, Google and Apple both moving in that direction following the Snowden revelations. And you could say that it was a political reaction, or you could say that actually just the technology evolved in such a way that it was feasible to bring very strong encryption to the consumer. So anyway, there is though this sort of conundrum or paradox or issue, which is that, okay, law enforcement can get it data on the cloud, but not data in the smartphone. And obviously, smartphones are going to be used for crimes, just like they're used for everything else. We're humans, we communicate with them.
And what does this do, both the larger issue, but also the way the government says, now, oh, we can get in anyway. What do you think that does to Apple's image, to its you know, its reputation in places like Europe and Asia, where there's already been a lot of concern about the government's ability to access this information?
Yeah, I mean, I think one really interesting aspect of this debate that we've had at the U.S. is that it's not a debate just in the U.S. It's clearly global. Apple is a global company. Google, Facebook, Microsoft, they're global companies. And so, you know, one could argue, oh, well, you know, a law enforcement agency in the U.S., there are proper means and channels to go ahead and effectuate a request. Apple's point has been consistently, you know, you, the United States government, are the first government in the world trying to mandate that we write software for you, and you are playing with fire when you do that. And actually, Apple strongly criticized the government. In one of the government's response motions in Riverside, the Justice Department cited some news reports saying, hey, Apple's already helping China to do this kind of thing. We've heard that. And Apple's attorney, Bruce Sewell, he described that as a sign of the government's desperation to cite news sources with unnamed sources, claiming that they had helped in China, and they said they haven't.
And Ashkan Soltani, what is your take on this notion that the Justice Department really just wanted a legal precedent here? They weren't so much needing help getting into the phone. What are your thoughts?
I think that's dead on. There's been for years now, and stemming back, you know, previous decades, there's been this debate of whether the government is essentially going dark in the sense that it's unable to access communications or planning and networks of individuals, or whether, as other people have framed, we're in this golden age of surveillance, in that when previously, we used to rely on ephemeral means of communications. I'd meet you in a corner, I'd meet you in a street, and I'd speak to you, but my conversations were not recorded digitally. There were not copies that were accessible. And digital technologies such as the iPhone and communicating with the internet have changed that. So there's been this debate for a while, and I think, number of government entities, this was raging on when I was in the White House and when I was at the FTC as well, this number of entities have different positions here. The challenge being, you know, do you set precedent such that the government can address this going dark debate, or do you acknowledge that by trying to set this precedent, you potentially undermine security of a number of devices outside of this particular single device, right? And I can get into that a little bit. The key challenge here is that, you know, every day now we as consumers rely on technologies that we don't design or we don't actually have any insights to. And, you know, this isn't just our phones. This is our refrigerators, our cars, you know, our, you know, any home IoT device. And we have to now worry that with this, if this precedent would be set, we have to worry that at any time the government might be able to compel that company to send a software update to that device, to our TV, to our car, to turn on, say, the microphone, the camera, or collect data that's stored on it. And I think that potentially for a lot of people might seem like overreach on the government's part.
All right, let's go to the phones. Again, the number to call, 866-733-6786, and we'll start in San Ramon. Fred, welcome. I'm sorry, actually, it's Shane in Florida.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, thanks. How are you?
Good, good.
You're on the air. Do you have a question?
Oh, I was just wanted to get your opinion on what you thought about Apple and the FBI's debate on encryption, where you have the FBI bringing up security concerns about connected cars. And encryption would certainly help that. But then out of the other side of their mouth, they want to weaken encryption.
Arthi?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what this Apple-FBI standoff over the iPhone is really doing is bringing out a debate about encryption. I mean, encryption is a topic that really, frankly, only geeks talked about before. And now suddenly people have iPhones and they think about this because it's in their hands. Or, I mean, largely geeks, not only, but largely. And, you know, there's a question, which is encryption ensures a kind of security, right? Basically, no one can get into this thing. And that means not criminal hackers, and it means not police. And, you know, that...
But people are hacking in all the time, it seems.
Yeah. And so I think that it raises a question, which is basically, like, I actually think that Apple and FBI are each having a security debate where each has a different cost-benefit analysis about whether encryption makes us more safe or impinges on, you know, sort of public safety and law enforcement ability to investigate crime. And so I think that there is really, for me, a question here, which is, are the negative externalities associated with encryption, which is basically keeping out an investigation if one is needed, do those outweigh the benefits? That's a question.
Yeah. Ashkan, anything you want to add to that?
I think that's also right. The key here is precisely how many people are able to access the data, right? And there's obviously different forms of encryption. There's, you know, the encryption that you use when you communicate to a website, say when you check in your bank online. And that's a form of encryption that allows only you and the website that you're connecting to see the data, but not anyone that might be eavesdropping on your communication. There's also encryption known as end-user encryption, which allows you to store information, say, on your iPhone or, say, even in the cloud with certain what are known as zero-knowledge encryption providers that don't even let the provider see the data, right? And this is what Apple has designed into their iPhone, essentially. And, you know, to the degree that we are worried about, you know, to the degree that the number of people that have access to the information increases the risk of that information being leaked or disclosed in a way we don't want, perhaps end-user encryption is important, right?
All right. Does that respond to your question, Shane?
Yeah.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go now to David in Oakland. Welcome.
Oh, hello. How are you this morning?
Good, thanks. How are you?
Good. I was calling because what I'm not hearing in this entire debate is the legality of the idea that government can compel a private corporation to develop software to work for the government with or without pay against its will. We have the 13th Amendment of the Constitution that prohibits slavery, and it seems to apply to this situation. Apple hasn't been convicted of a crime. They can't be forced to do labor for the government against its will, and I'm just wondering why this issue isn't being discussed by Apple.
Arthi?
Well, yeah, I actually do think that this issue of burden and Apple's argument that this is an unreasonable burden has been a very big part of the debate. You know, I actually went back and read a Supreme Court ruling. The last time the Supreme Court weighed in on whether a telecommunications company could be forced to do something under the All Writs Act being the 18th century law that the government was invoking, it was a case of New York Telephone. This was 1977. And what happened was that the FBI was trying to crack down on a gambling ring. Okay, it wasn't like mass shooter. It was a gambling ring that they thought was operating.
Seems quaint now.
It does seem quaint. But, you know, but it was operating Manhattan's east side, 14th Street, to be exact. And basically, there were two phone lines that the FBI wanted to be able to monitor the outgoing calls from with a pen register to basically map out the network of gamblers that were contributing to this illegal gambling ring. And New York Telephone was willing to provide some help, which was to say, to point out to the FBI, these are the lines you actually need to tap into. And so feel free to go and run some wires from, you know, the apartment where this is operating.
With a court order.
With a court order, not just free. Exactly. With a court order, the FBI had probable cause. Feel free to run some wires to wherever it is you want to set up your surveillance operation. But FBI was like, guys, we cased the building. There's no way for us to run these wires without giving away that we're doing this to the gambling ring. So we actually want you to free up some lines you have available so we can try this other method to listen it or to monitor. And New York Telephone didn't want to do it. And New York Telephone said that it was an unreasonable burden. They had privacy concerns. And they went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And then the Supreme Court ruled in 5-4, New York Telephone, you got to do it.
And so that's the precedent that stands today.
That is a precedent that's been cited by both sides in different ways. The government saying us invoking an 18th century law is not crazy, as weird and dusty and old as it might sound, because it's happened as recently as 1977 in the Supreme Court case. And you know what? The Constitution's venerable, so is this law. Apple has said, okay, but that New York Telephone case, they weren't being compelled to go and write software for the government. This is a whole new kind of ask that has never happened before.
Well, in that regard, Ashkan Sultani, is it time that we do update the law and the legal precedent, given how much the world has changed? We're not just chasing down gambling rings.
I think the question really is around how broad do we want to make the reach of the government in terms of their ability and oversight of technology.
And to right? what extent does the threat, should the threat be figured into that question?
The other key point of the Apple response was that they're morally against this kind of precedent, right? So they believe that security is in such a state that any efforts to undermine the individual security is just a morally wrong direction to go. And I happen to agree. Right, you mentioned, Scott, you mentioned the amount to which breaches and consumer data breaches and hacking has gone up over recent months and years. The thing to consider is, to the degree that companies are unable to protect consumers' information, consumers should have tools that they can then themselves protect their own private communications and messages and photos and whatnot, right? And I think people might argue that creating tools that undermine that and put more consumers at more risk is actually morally a wrong decision to go.
All right, David, thanks very much for that call and comment. We've got some email here. Richard writes, if Apple opens the phone, they might keep a copy of what is in it, leaving them in a position to dispute the value of that data. If the government drops the suit now, they can hint that there was lots of data that was useful but cannot be revealed. It's too easy for the government to exaggerate or lie to win public opinion. And then Peter writes, I wonder what will happen if the iPhone's reputation if the FBI gets into the San Bernardino iPhone without Apple's help and without telling the world, Apple included, how it succeeded. Interesting question, huh? I mean, Apple would like to know, I guess.
Well, I think that there's sort of, two headlines from the news on Monday. One is FBI backs down, or rather Justice Department backs down, does 180 from its briefs. Or the other is, wait, law enforcement might have a way to break into that iPhone and a whole bunch of others?
What's the limit there?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right, let's go back to the phones, and let's go to El Cerrito this time. Actually, to Palo Alto. And Ron, good morning.
Good morning. I like your guest's reflection on the point, and that is that Apple's long-term strategy is to become a very, very big force in the payment processing market. They look at this as $100 billion over the years, and much as they've seized a good part of the music distribution industry and the telephone handset business, they're marching into this and want to take over that. They want the phone to be the ATM in your hand, and even beyond that, to work with the watch to be your major health monitor, and all that depends on very, very high security. So what the FBI is doing in this.
I don't know if we lost Ron there, but I think we know where he was going. There's obviously a lot at stake here as Apple looks ahead in its own market future, Arthi.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that comment really goes to this point about, you know, what are the trade-offs when we leave a channel for law enforcement to get in, when the smartphone is becoming the repository for your banking, your medical records, your personal diary? I mean, it's a lot more than just a way to make a call, right? Yeah.
But every time you find a way in, doesn't it also help create a patch? I mean, help strengthen the encryption in a way, although in this case, it's the government finding out, not Apple.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that that's right. So, I mean, actually, it's also interesting whether the government will, you know, let Apple know how they plan to get in so that Apple can improve its security.
Yeah. Ashkan, were you trying to say something there?
No, that's right.
Oh, okay.
It's a question of whether the government will disclose what the avenue they took for this particular phone. The thing I think most of your kind of listeners should be aware of, though, is that there's no perfect security, right? So with enough time, you can essentially break nearly any system, right? Oftentimes, the encryption itself might be sound, but there might be other ways. For example, in this case, it's speculated that they would lift the memory chip off the device and create a copy so that they could have infinite attempts at it. Again, not directly attacking the encryption, but attacking the framework. And so there's no perfect security of any system, right? The question is, how hard or how expensive do you make it to break a phone or a system or a particular communications mechanism? And I think without disclosure of this vulnerability, it's still likely that Apple is going to improve the security of each successive phone, as will other companies. I suspect the method the FBI might be able to use for this phone will not work, for example, for future versions of the iPhone. And this debate is going to continue and require kind of a policy decision kind of with us as a society.
All right. Thanks very much. Really quickly, Arthi, this case has been suspended. So what now?
So the Justice Department has until April 5th to go ahead and give a status report to the court to know whether they were able to get into the phone or not.
All right, and I'm sure you'll be right on top of that. Arthi Shahani, tech reporter for NPR, thanks so much for coming
in.
Thank you. And thanks also to Ashkan Zoltani for joining us as well, former senior advisor to the U.S. Chief Technology Officer at the White House. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Suki Lewis, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from Amanda Font. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our executive producer is Joanne Wallace. For all of us here at KQED, I'm Scott Schaefer.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.